It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strangehamps. Is there a book that left a mark on you? A book you've read and reread more than once? A book you can't forget?
It took some time before she was used to the movement, and then she felt a wild exhilaration. She was riding a bear.
Writer Chloe Benjamin picks The Golden Compass by Philip Pullman.
Lyra wanted to talk to the bear, but he was so strange and wild and cold that she was shy, almost for the first time in her life. So as he loped along, his great legs swinging tirelessly, she sat with the movement and said nothing. And all around was the bitter Arctic cold and the immense silence of the North.
We interview a lot of writers on this show. And for years, we've been asking them to tell us about a favorite book. And thanks to them, we have traveled from the streets of Harlem to 19th century St. Petersburg in the snow, from a Nazi concentration camp to a madwoman's attic, and from the witches of Eastwick to that mysterious northern land of armored bears. Here's what I've learned. The relationships we have with books can be among the most profound and meaningful of our lives. Books can dazzle, entrance, comfort, and also enrage us. They can shape our thinking, even the course of our lives. But we don't often talk about them that way, unless we're asked. This week, I'd like to invite you to subscribe to something brand new, Bookmarks. Our new weekly micro-podcast. Tiny true stories by writers about books. They sound like this.
This is Anne Lamott, and a book that changed my life forever was Pippi Longstocking's. I was an early reader and found literal salvation in chapter books. The first one I remember was Pippi Longstocking's, about this little Swedish girl with braids that stuck straight out, one black sock and one brown sock, and a horse that lived with her, and a monkey whose name I think was Mr. Nilsson. And her father was the king of a cannibal island. He had floated off somewhere. I don't remember if we know what happened to her mother, but she lived alone next to slightly priggish Swedish girls whose names I think are Tommy and Annika. And she radicalizes them. She gets them to do things that are way scarier than I would ever do. She teaches them to go a little farther beyond their garden than they've ever gone before. She makes them laugh. Sometimes she just picks up her horse and carries them out to the front porch for a little fresh air. And when I read that book, I thought, there's a place in this world for me, for odd, strange, strong me. And I thank the author every few days. We had this one funky little window seat, or what we called a window seat, which was kind of a very, very small space jammed up against a window. And that was my safety spot. That was if I was there, and if you were reading, you could get away with it. You know, if you were sitting at the kitchen table trying to figure out all of life because you'd just been hanging out with, like, Catholics or some other strange family, a grown-up would come along and say, don't you have something to do? Don't you have homework? Or is your room clean? But if you had a book in your hands, they'd come by and smile at you. And I remember the cover. I remember those braids and those freckles and that goofy skirt and that one long black knee sock and one long brown knee sock. She was always making pancakes and flipping them, and they got stuck on the ceiling all the time. She was like Ruth Gordon in Harold and Maude, you know, and Harold and Maude was a movie that changed my life forever. Forever. I had this kinky, short, nappy, whitish blonde hair, so I couldn't do the braids. And other girls would do the braids for Halloween. They put wire in their braids. So, of course, I was completely bitter and jealous about that. But, you know, we didn't have enough money ever. And so sometimes my socks would kind of not match. They'd be the same color, but they wouldn't be from the same pair. One does what one can.
Anne Lamott, forever marked by Pippi Longstocking. So here's another thing I've noticed. People really remember the first books they fall in love with. That came up in a conversation I had on stage with three writers, Chloe Benjamin, Natalia Sylvester, and Rebecca Traister. They were each sharing a favorite book, and Chloe read that excerpt from Philip Pullman's Golden Compass, and then Rebecca confessed a secret fear.
Do you feel like in reading those books and loving them so much when you were 13, you hit a high that you can never get back to?
Oh, God. That's so upsetting.
As a reader. No, I wonder this. I wonder this because my daughter, who's a voracious reader, and she's almost 8, she read all the Harry Potters, all of them, twice, and says to me, every other book pales. And I worry about this because I'm like, no, believe me, there's others. but I do worry about that. You know, if there's something that gets in your heart or your head really firmly at a young age, is everything else just a letdown?
You know, I don't know, because I read Harry Potter for the first time when I was 30.
So did I.
Yeah.
What did you guys both think? Well, I'm so curious.
I hesitated to read it because I, like, sometimes with books are really hyped, I'm like, yeah, whatever, it can't be that great. And then I was like, oh my God, these are so good. And it took me a while because I thought, like, oh, let me space it out. So it really became, like, my year of Harry Potter, beginning in, like, around Christmas time, December to December. And I didn't know what I was going to do after that. There was a time where I was like, I don't want to have dinner right now. I don't want to do anything. I just want to go back to that world.
Actually, for me, it was in the wake of a breakup. It was in my late 20s. It was in the wake of a breakup, and I was like, fuck it, I'm just going to read the book about the wizards. And somehow, in needing a refuge, I really found one that took me back to youth, and it was comforting. It's so funny that you specified it was Christmas to Christmas, because for me, those books are that. They're cozy.
Absolutely.
They're like putting on a blanket, and it's cozy, and it feels like childhood Christmases. So I read this book when I was in eighth grade, the same year I read Their Eyes Were Watching God, which I loved. I hated my Antonia. It was so boring that I wanted to gouge my eyes out. But when I was in college, I went back and I read it again. And basically from the beginning to the end, I wept. As I wandered over those rough pastures, I had the good luck to stumble upon a bit of the first road that went from Black Hawk out to the North Country. Was all that was left of that old road which used to run like a wild thing across the open prairie. On the level land, the tracks had almost disappeared, were mere shadings in the grass. The rains had made channels of the wheel ruts and washed them so deeply that the sod had never healed over them. They looked like gashes on the slopes where the farm wagons used to lurch up out of the hollows with a pull that brought curling muscles on the smooth hips of the horses. I sat down and watched the haystacks turn rosy in that slanting sunlight. This was the road over which she and I came on that night when we got off the train at Black Hawk and were bedded down in the straw. Wondering children being taken, we knew not whither. I had only to close my eyes to hear the rumbling of the wagons in the dark and to be again overcome by that obliterating strangeness. The feelings of that night were so near that I could reach out and touch them with my hand. I had the sense of coming home to myself and of having found out what a little circle man's experience is. For she and for me, this had been the road of destiny. Now I understood that the same road was to bring us together again. Whatever we had missed, we possessed together the precious, the incommunicable past.
You warned me that that book was an emotional experience for you, so tell us why.
So I did know for a couple reasons that I might cry, because to me this book is ultimately about how hard it is to love America and how hard America is, how hard the United States is, and what it asks of us and what we're ultimately able to give it and what we're not. I'm 43. I haven't read it probably since I was 30. I haven't gone back to it again.
So I got a copy. I'm on book tour, and I was reading it on the plane, and I was sobbing, reading it on the plane again. And that passage I just read, I realize I love for a slightly different reason, which is about the tracks of the wagon wheels. And I think about the kind of work that I try to do in a very not a scholarly way, which is go back and find the history that's been covered over and where there's been marks made in the land. And that was not a perspective I'd had on it until this afternoon. We're extremely sleep deprived after 2 weeks of book tour. I was on the plane with a guy who was pouring his Jack Daniels on my pants. And that really happened. And I was sobbing. So that's my story about my Antonia.
What were you thinking, Natalia?
Well, I mean, this isn't a novel, but when I was very young, there was a time when, you know, as immigrants, we couldn't go back to Peru because we were trying to get all our paperwork sorted out. So my sister and I, you know, we started our education here, and we would go to school, and then we'd come home, and it would turn out that my mom had asked her friends who were going back and forth to Peru to bring home Peruvian history books. So we'd be like, cool, we're done with school. And she'd be like, no. You still have history to learn. And she would teach us from Peruvian history books. And that was incredibly a very different perspective than that we learned in the U.S. in my school, especially, like, I mean, in second grade, it was 92, the 500th year anniversary of Christopher Columbus discovering America. And we were learning about the ways in which Pizarro eliminated and ravaged and basically murdered an entire civilization in the Incas. My mom would, even the way she would teach it to us, and she'd be like, oh gosh, these horrible people. And she'd be really angry. She would tell us about the Incas and all the things that we'll never know about how they did what they did because nobody bothered to even consider their knowledge valuable before they were killed. I think what it really just taught me was that there were two sides, not even two sides, but so much more than two sides, and that the power is in who gets to tell the story.
Your point, Natalia, then makes me want to go back and read all of my Antonia again with that view.
But that's interesting, really interesting thing about there's still iconic books that are important, so then what do we do? Do we keep reading them and annotate them? Do we put them in a dark corner and say, no, those were bad books?
You know, somebody asked me that question recently about Lolita, and this might be a controversial opinion, but I was like, I'm okay leaving it behind. I'm not saying that it's erased. I'm saying, does it have to be on every single high school reading list from now until the end of eternity if it got us to this moment in time? Or are we able to acknowledge that that's part of our history? And can we also then make room for new literature? You know, I'm ready for that. I'm so ready for that.
That's part of a conversation I had at the Wisconsin Book Festival with Natalia Sylvester, author of Everyone Knows You Go Home, Rebecca Traister, author of Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger, and Chloe Benjamin, author of The Immortalists. And speaking of making room for new literature, here's this year's American Book Award winner, Tommy Orange, on the book that made him want to be a writer.
I was eating a donut, and I just realized what a novel could do for the first time. Hi, I'm Tommy Orange, author of There, There. The book I want to recommend is Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole. He did not see it published. He committed suicide. His mom got it published, and it won the Pulitzer posthumously. And it's about Ignatius J. Reilly in New Orleans. He has a contentious relationship with his mom, lives with his mom still. He's already gone to grad school. He has a bus story that he always wants to tell about something that was not that serious, but he makes into this tragedy. His mom wants him to get a job. He's also sort of writing, sort of wants to be a writer. He's overweight. He drinks Dr. Nutt, and he watches this dance show on TV often and makes fun of it. He hates it, but he can't stop watching it. Myrna Minks is sort of his love interest, but he sort of hates and loves her too. anyway, it's just filled with delightful absurdity, and he's a fantastic writer. There are tons of lines in there that are just stunning. I was working at a used bookstore right when I fell in love with reading for the first time, pretty late in life. I mean, it was in my 20s. Late for a reader. I was on a break, and I was reading Confederacy of Dunces. It was about 100 pages. It's not a straightforward narrative. It's experimental, and it's absurd. It's funny, but it's profound. And it was the first time I realized I wanted to write a novel. It took a long time to even get to an attempt, but it was a real moment for me because I realized what a novel could do, and maybe even started in my own way dreaming about what that might look like for me.
Tommy Orange. His debut novel, There, There, won the 2019 American Book Award, the Penn Hemingway Award, and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. He's an enrolled member of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma. We're introducing a new podcast today, stories from your favorite writers about their favorite books. It's called Bookmarks, and you can find out more at ttbook.org/bookmarks. We'll be sampling a few this hour and talking with other book lovers about this reading life. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
So I have a theory, and I'm wondering if you would accept this. And this is sort of based on my own experience, that the most powerful reading experiences are when you're quite young.
This is Steve Paulson.
You're a fairly innocent reader still. You don't have that much life experience that's going to sort of filter your response. And for me, at least, I read books all the time. I do it for work. But when I think back on those seminal reading experiences, I don't know if it can match the power of when I was 20 years old.
You know, that makes me sad. Steve is our executive producer, and he's also my husband. The man adores books. The idea that his peak reading is already behind him is kind of heartbreaking. But here's what another voracious reader has to say. Pamela Paul, editor of the New York Times Book Review.
I would absolutely agree with you, and on many levels. Let's take very, very young children. When you're a parent and you're looking at board books to show to your toddler, you might have this initial reaction of like, well, this book is about airplanes. My child actually hasn't been on an airplane yet, so I can't really read that because they're not going to know what it's about. They're not going to be able to relate to it. And yet, of course you can. That's how they become introduced to that concept. And then imagine then what it's like when they go on an airplane for the first time, or they've already seen it in a book. So you are encountering the world as a child through books before you actually encounter it in real life. In many circumstances, they see people of all different walks of life first in books. And so the fundamental experience often for a child is first through the pages of books, which is a kind of amazing thing.
Yeah. That world of books can seem more real than your waking world that you look at.
That's the first encounter. And that's why I think that it is so smart that the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends no screen time until at least the age of two. In part, I think, because there are many very good pedagogical reasons why they recommend that, but I would rather a child encounter it through the pages of a book first, have that experience first, than, let's say, on a website or on a TV show. And then you think about emotions and think about an older child, let's say a teenager, when you're experiencing really intense emotions for the first time in a lot of ways, especially related to love and sex, but also anger on a different level and just the full range. And when you read a novel that reflects those emotions and the intensity that mirrors the intensity that you as a teenager feel, that's a profound connection.
You're almost suggesting that we'll never match that reading experience when we were teenagers.
I mean, it's interesting. I'm in a book club that only reads children's literature. We go between sort of middle grade fiction, which is what we refer to. It has nothing to do with middle school. It's the term that essentially is like children's literature. Lion and the Witch and the Wardrobe, A Wrinkle in Time, those are middle grade novels. That's what we think of as children's literature. And then we also read YA. And when I talk to some of my fellow members about why they like to read children's books, and they don't all have children, they don't all like children, or why they want to read these books, it's because the intensity, the things that happen then, they feel so important at that time, and the rawness. And you can really go back and kind of feel that again. I mean, I think there's this whole new thing of crossover YA, of young right. adult fiction that adults read as well. And the book that most people think of when they think about that is John Green's The Fault in Our Stars. And that's a love story between two terminally ill or very ill cancer patients. So you know there's going right. to be some sadness. And I can, you know, I choke up even thinking about it, but it reminds you of what it's like to fall in love at that age for the first time.
When you were talking about a crossover book, I thought you were going to mention Philip Pullman's The Golden Compass.
Well, that's another great one. And there are also profound philosophical questions in that book. And that brings me to a third thing, which I think happens mostly in that sort of golden middle part, that children's literature world, which is fantasy and other worlds. And it's when you really, I think, begin to imagine that the world could be entirely different. There could be totally different rules. And I think that's why a lot of kids who later go on to read genre fiction or sometimes only read it in childhood, those kinds of fantasy, science fiction, adventure stories, it really is a kind of opening up of the world. You know, we become jaded over time. And of course, many of us will still continue to read in those genres and to have that total removal from time and space that we normally occupy. But it first happens when you're a child.
So I have a friend who's a retired children's book editor, and she says that by far the most important thing that has happened in the world of children's books, say over the last two decades, was Harry Potter. That just turned a whole new generation or multiple generations of kids into reading. Would you agree?
I think Harry Potter was a game changer for a number of reasons. I think that Harry Potter was the first time in a lifetime of, I would say, three generations now at this point, millennials, Gen X, and, you know, this latest generation, whether you want to call them the digital generation or Gen Z, but it was particularly strong for millennials and Gen X, where one of those series was coming out in real time in our lives, so that you had to wait between right. those stories for those installations. It's been a while since that happened. You know that, yes, to a certain extent with Philip Pullman earlier in The Golden Compass, the Dark Materials series, and yes, with Narnia, those books were earlier, but this was the first time for these generations. And
I remember when my daughter was a teenager. This is back when Borders was still around. They would start the sale at midnight. We were there at midnight.
People would queue up. And that's the second thing is that it was a communal experience. And it was a communal experience, again, for these two generations before the internet. The Harry Potter sort of phenomenon crossed over into the era of the internet, but really began before. The other major thing that Harry Potter did is that not only aged along with its readers, but it pulled grown-ups in as well. And it made Harry Potter into a kind of family experience because the grown-ups wanted to know what the kids were reading, and the kids wanted to have their adults read the books to them before they could read them themselves. And people of all ages found that they enjoyed these books just as much. And I don't know, you know, you'd almost have to go back to things like Wilkie Collins and Dickens to, like, recapture the idea of, like, a real family reading experience, or maybe Little House on the Prairie. But there aren't many books that can capture people of all ages in that way. And so that was the first time I really think, in the course of my lifetime, at least, that that's happened. Hmm.
So I want to step back for a moment and come back to your history, your personal history as a reader. And you've talked about what you've called the book of books, where you've recorded every book that you've read since high school.
Yes. Bob, which is what I call him, which stands for Book of Books, was a blank book that I bought when I was a junior in high school, and I've been filling it out ever since, and I have gone back and started numbering them.
So why do you keep this list of all the books you've ever read since you were a junior in high school?
You know, I think at heart, I was a failed teenage diarist. I tried to keep a more traditional form of diary, and I, like any teenager, you know, who sort of thinks of herself as the writerly type, scribbling away like Joe March. And it turned out that I really was terrible as a teenage diarist. I only wrote when I was upset. And I was generally upset about the very ordinary things that teenage girls are upset about, you know, sleepovers that didn't happen and fights with your parents. And I would go back and reread these journals. And so ultimately, I decided, rather than write about the kind of ordinariness of my life at that time, I would write about where I often felt I really was, which was in the world of books. It was where I was psychologically, mentally, spiritually. I was in a drawing room in an English countryside, or running through a field, or traveling through another country. And so that's what I began to do.
You've had this, obviously, for years, for decades now. Do you feel like this is, to some degree, your autobiography?
Yeah. I don't remember the plots necessarily of each of those books, but I remember everything around it. I remember what the book looked like. I remember where I bought it. I remember where I borrowed it or who gave it to me. I remember why I read it at that moment. And I remember where I was when I read them. I remember if I was on a beach or if I was reading it on a bus. It all comes back to me.
Pamela Paul is the author of How to Raise a Reader, and she's the editor of the New York Times Book Review. Steve Paulson is the executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge, and he's not the only one on our staff who reads a lot.
It's November, which means I'm starting to get ready for one of my favorite nights of the year. It's when I gather with a group of super smart, funny women and make an entire reading plan for the next 12 months together.
You guys, now you have to take home leftovers.
This is our producer, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and her book club.
When you get a chance, you have to write down a wish for Lainey.
As an only child, books were my first friends, and my mom took me to the library every week. When I was an English major in college, I learned to love discussing plots and symbolism, characters and dialogue. But it took this, my book club of 12 women, now in our 10th year, to give these friendships the language and depth that comes from collective reading. Part of what works is the ritual, the sameness, the welcoming open door on the third Thursday of the month. At our book choosing meeting at the end of the year, always at Jenny's house, we'll pick 11 books to read over the next year, one a month until next December. One of our members described the way we choose the books as magic. And it is, in a way.
It is. It's genius.
Yeah, it works. Like, we have a method.
I like to be
We have a really good method.
It is good.
Renee's a great organizer. We have a method.
We each come armed with books we want to pitch. Some people have one book they want, and that's it. Some have a whole list of the year's top award winners.
Man Booker.
Sorry. Man Booker.
So what about Man Booker?
Our literary drinking game is to take a drink, almost always a sip of wine, whenever anyone says Man Booker.
Man Booker.
We often rely on the Man Booker prize to help us.
What are we going to drink?
What you got?
What are we going to drink?
Pulitzer.
Prairie Award, Caldecott.
Renee, who is a marketing genius, brings her laptop, and as each person pitches her book or books, she charts our reactions and excitement level.
I listen to your voices and the level and... No, seriously, I do.
I listen to the
conversation and how excited
I'm
you guys are.
I'm thinking that I needed to start doing my research.
When we've all had a turn, she can say, okay, these are the top few. We also make cookies to swap, which is why my kids consider this the best book club of the year, because they wake up in the morning to a delicious, dizzying array of arugula, pizzelles, and Mexican chocolate cookies.
Did everybody have cupcakes?
No,
I did make all these cupcakes for you people.
We really do talk about the books.
Okay, I made little mini cupcakes.
How are they?
But we also talk about life.
Did you get enough tequila in there?
No, I had one.
Over the years, we've raised our kids together, negotiated driver's licenses, proms, swim teams, dance lessons, and the evolution of Snapchat and TikTok.
That's what we talk about at book club.
shoes waxing lice.
Oh, God.
We almost always come around to talking about lice again.
I don't know. Has anyone ever really over lice?
We've offered to search each other's heads for lice. And if that isn't true friendship, I don't know what is. We've celebrated bat mitzvahs and graduations, along with our own milestones of big birthdays, remarriages, and professional awards. But we really come out for each other when it's tough. And we have had our share of that. Bringing food to the three of us who have gone through breast cancer, taking each other to treatments and tests, celebrating shaved heads, and all clear reports. We are like a big family of sisters through divorces, moves, and our bittersweet specialty of making book club cookies for funerals. Three times this past year.
Yeah, it was.
Do you guys remember the very first book we read? It was a novel.
I always think
of this book.
I know. And it just irritated everyone so much.
These are the women for whom I will continue to read a book I don't even like, just so we can talk about it.
It's like extremely loud, incredibly close. That
thinking of you, Jonathan Franzen, and Freedom.
Oh,
I am Freedom.
Freedom.
I didn't like it, but I love you guys enough to keep going with it.
There are now close to 100 books we've read together.
Educated by Tara Westover.
Yes.
I could not finish that. Oh, and I loved American Marriage by Tara
Westover. Yes. That was my favorite. That was such a good book.
And The Great Believer.
The Great Believer.
Oh, The Great Believer.
I mean, remember Ages for Hawk was a great one.
We might still all be friends if we weren't in a book club, but the strong woven string of thinking about the same characters and settings, about story and language, binds us together in a different way.
So, I can't even tell you how many times I have read a book, thought I didn't like it, and then I come and listen to all of you guys, and I
was like, yeah, and then you're like,
oh
my God,
I didn't think about that.
Books are much more than an excuse for meeting with these women who I dearly love. When we share ideas with each other, we share some of ourselves. And when we share books, we deepen our connection to each other and to the world.
Bye, Julia.
I know. I was very self-conscious. I have to get home.
Can you take a plate of cupcakes down to your family?
Yes.
We'll take cupcakes.
I don't want any. I had one. That's all I can eat.
She has to take some to her family.
Shannon Henry Kleiber and her book club, now heading into their 10th year together. So we are also celebrating this hour, welcoming our brand new baby podcast to the world. It's called Bookmarks, tiny weekly stories from writers about books they love, books they can't forget. Like this, a black gay poet discovers sex through one of the whitest writers in American history. Want the story?
My name is Jericho Brown, and I am the author of The Tradition. My bookmark is The Witches of Eastwick by John Updike, which I think is really hilarious. But when I was a kid, this movie came out and it had Cher and Susan Sarandon and Michelle Pfeiffer and Jack Nicholson, and it was called The Witches of Eastwick. And when we went to the movie theater, my mom and dad wouldn't let me and my sister go see it. We had to go to a different theater and see a different movie. And I was confounded for two reasons. One, it had Cher. And two, it was about witches. Certainly it was for me. So when I was a kid, I was the kind of nerd that spent a lot of time in libraries. And I came across this book on the shelf, and it said, The Witches of Eastwick. And being a kid, I thought, oh, wow, somebody turned this movie into a book. And I opened the book anywhere, and I saw the word genitals. And I was a smart kid, so I knew that if I didn't know a word, I had to go look it up. So I went to the very big dictionary that was in the center of the library, and I started turning pages until I got to the word genitals. And this is how I learned the word genitals. So I ran back to where the book was, and when I tell you, I mean, I must have been 8 or 9, I read it from cover to cover. So everything I knew about sex, I was learning from this book. So later, like much later, maybe 20 years later, I met John Updike. And the wonderful thing about that meeting was that I could go up to him and say, you know, my dad never had that talk with me, but everything I needed to know about sex education, I got from you. And he looked at me and he said, you know, I think this is the best story I've ever heard about any one of my books. Thank you so much.
Jericho Brown won the American Book Award for his first book of poems called Please. His most recent collection, The Tradition, is a finalist for the 2019 National Book Award. Bookmarks is a micro podcast. Season 1 begins this week. Find out more and subscribe at ttbook.org/bookmarks. It's brought to you by, to the best of our knowledge, from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Some of my favorite childhood memories are of going to the library with my mother and sister. I remember the smell of the books, the feel of those crinkly dust jackets. In the children's section, I can still see all my old favorites in alphabetical order, from Aiken to Zolotow. Writer Susan Orlean has surprisingly similar memories. She writes about them and about books in general in her new bestseller, The Library Book. We met on stage at the National Writer Series in Michigan recently, and she talked about rediscovering libraries and becoming fascinated with one in particular.
I had just moved to LA, and I was asked to give a talk for the Friends of the Library. At the end of the talk, the head of the Friends said he, as a thank you, would like to give me a tour of the downtown library. And I was very excited because I didn't know LA had a downtown. And I immediately fell in love with the library. It's just, it's a quite unique piece of architecture, a sort of blend of Egyptian and Art Deco, if you can imagine that. I was very taken with this place. We stopped in front of the fiction section, and he pulled a book off the shelf, and he held it up, and he took a deep whiff of the book. And I didn't know what to do. I thought, I'm new to LA. I don't know if this is... And then I thought, do I take that same book and smell it? Or do I, like, take another book? And I really didn't know what to do. I didn't understand it. He said, you know, you can still smell the smoke in some of them. I said, did they used to let people smoke in the library? And he said, no, no, smoke from the fire. And I said... From what fire?
It was the fire that destroyed the LA Public Library. And that's the story Susan tells in the library book.
It was the largest library fire in American history. It burned for 7.5 hours and reached over 2,500 degrees. When it was finally extinguished at the end of those 7 hours, 400,000 books had been destroyed.
Wow.
And 700,000 were damaged. And it was determined that it was arson.
The section where you describe the actual fire, it was a particular special kind of fire. So could you read that passage? It's on page 25.
Yes, in the physics of fire, there is a chemical phenomenon known as a stoichiometric condition, in which a fire achieves the perfect burning ratio of oxygen to fuel, which results in total combustion. Many firefighters have never seen such a blaze and never will. Not long ago, I had coffee with a man named Ron Hamill. He was a captain in the fire department. He talked about it like someone might talk about seeing a UFO. Usually, a fire is red and orange and yellow and black. The fire in the library was colorless. You could look right through it as if it were a sheet of glass. Where the flame had any color, it was pale blue. It was so hot that it appeared icy. Hamill said he felt like he was standing inside a blacksmith's forge. We thought we were looking at the bowels of hell.
So, why do you think the burning of books is so horrific to us? Just last week, students at Georgia Southern University burned the books of a Cuban-American novelist on a grill while she was visiting. If they had just shouted her down in the lecture, we wouldn't be reading about it in the national newspapers. It's the fact and the image of her book on a grill that is so viscerally revolting. Why is that?
Books and libraries have a connection to us that is beyond the logical. They exist as a sort of extension of the human mind and spirit. And I think we feel that deeply, as if a book has a soul. At the base of that is the fact that books are immortal. So yeah. Books can be the one thing that we can't be. There is a mystically potent quality that a book has. I mean, it really feels like a voice talking to you.
Isn't there an African proverb, something like, when an old man dies, a library burns?
That became the organizing principle of the book to me. I had come across that expression, and about halfway through working on the book, my mother was diagnosed with dementia. And suddenly I began understanding the meaning of that proverb, that her internal library was burning down. Her memories, her knowledge was disappearing almost volume by volume. And similarly, a library is a communal mind. So when you lose a whole library, you lose this shared mind of a society. You know, the Nazis had a squad that was assigned one mission, which was to seek out and burn libraries, purely for the emotional and psychological terror that it filled people with, that feeling of that's our communal memory, that's who we are.
It's not just the Nazis who burned books. World War II also destroyed so many libraries. I haven't heard anybody really describe the damage to books in quite the way you do.
I have to say I was shocked. 20 major libraries containing 2 million books were destroyed in Italy. France lost millions more. In Metz, officials hid the library's most valuable books in an unmarked warehouse for safekeeping. A German soldier found the warehouse and threw an incendiary device into it. Most of the books, including rare 11th and 13th century manuscripts, were destroyed. During the Blitz, 20 million books in Great Britain burned or were wrecked by the water used to extinguish the fires. The losses in Germany were astonishing. Most of the library books in cities including Bremen, Stuttgart, Leipzig, Dresden, Munich, Hanover, and Hamburg were incinerated. By the end of the war, more than one-third of all the books in Germany were gone.
Wow. So you say somewhere in the book, as long as we've been building libraries, we've been burning them. And I was thinking a corollary, a more hopeful corollary, is as long as we've been burning books, people have been rescuing them.
True.
Some of the most poignant scenes to me in the book are about the librarians who worked in that LA library and saw the library burn. Many of them stood there for the whole 7 hours watching it, heartbroken, and who then spent all those following years doing what they could to kind of save some of the books.
They really were amazing. I mean, for them, it was utterly devastating. The city employed a psychologist to meet with them and work with them because people were traumatized. Many of them then got involved in the kind of amazing process of restoring those 700,000 books that were damaged, which, I mean, they had to be frozen solid. You know, they were wet. And you either have to dry a book within 48 hours or it's going to mold and it'll be ruined forever. So if you can't dry it quickly, you have to freeze it. The city contacted all these frozen food warehouses and said, can we store some books? This is how I picture the conversation. Can we store some books for a couple days? And then it's like, here are 700,000 books for 7 years.
And they're calling bird's
yes,
eye.
Yes, yes.
Could you move the frozen peas aside?
And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, I was saying to somebody, do any of the books smell like broccoli? Because they were stored next to frozen food for 7 years. But then it's a very complicated thing. These books had soaked up hundreds of gallons of water. So McDonnell Douglas and the Jet Propulsion Lab got involved in trying to figure out how do we dry these books. And they put them in chambers that are used to test the equipment that goes into outer space. It was the largest book restoration project ever undertaken.
But don't you love this image of the book as one of the oldest technologies with the most contemporary technology being used
amazing.
To save them?
Yeah, it's amazing. There was a lot of good that came out of this epically bad event. And that was one of them, the way the people of LA came together and said, we have to save the library. I mean, they had to remove the 700,000 books. That in itself was a major undertaking. thousands of people in LA showed up the next day, put on hard hats, and formed a human chain and passed the books out of the library.
Wow. Well, before we let a writer go, we often ask them to recommend a book for us. So I want to ask you, we call them bookmarks, because double entendre, the book you'd like to mark and the book that marked you. So before I let you go, can you give us a bookmark?
My bookmark is a classic. It's The Sound and the Fury by William Faulkner. It's the first book that I ever began rereading before I finished reading it. I was so swept away, so dazzled, so truly astonished by the book that I had gone on vacation with my family and we were somewhere wonderful and warm and beachy and I wouldn't leave the hotel room. I just wanted to read that book, and then I began rereading it at the same time. Fast forward many years, and I get fixed up with a guy, and I'm told he's an investment banker. And I thought, I don't want to go out with an investment banker. But he was a friend of a friend, and I thought, I don't want to be rude, so I'll go. To be honest, I didn't know what investment bankers did, but I didn't like the sound of it. I went and I met this man, and I thought, I'm just going to tolerate this and get out as soon as possible. And we sat down for dinner, and for some reason he said to me, what's your favorite book? And I thought, well, I'm going to stump him and sort of turn the tables. I said, what's your favorite book? Thinking he'd say, you know, Investment Banking 101. And he said, The Sound and the Fury. My husband. There you go. And we had a ritual for the first years that we knew each other where once a year we'd go away for a weekend and read the book together.
Oh.
I know. I know. It's just too wonderful. I still don't know what investment bankers do, but I'm...
But you married one.
Yes, I'm safe.
Susan Orlean is the author of The Library Book, and we were talking on stage at the National Writer Series in Traverse City, Michigan. Thanks to its organizers, Anne and Doug Stanton. Thanks also to Peter Payette and Interlochen Public Radio, and also to Connor Moran and the Wisconsin Book Festival put on by the Madison Public Library. And to all you book lovers, I'll end with an invitation. Check out our new podcast, Bookmarks. Subscribe, review, and share it. You'll find it wherever you get your podcasts, and you can also find out more at ttbook.org/bookmarks. Brought to you by all of us at To the Best of Our Knowledge.